Accession number 29724, Reel 1.
Jim, so there's Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Yes, born in Gillingham, Kent. December 1918.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was an electrical engineer and served in the RNAS during World War One as an engineer. talked very little about his service, so I don't know very much about it. But prior to going into the RNAS, he was for a short time with the Royal Warwicks. His school had an officer's training corps, and I think he went straight into that. But clearly his heart was in engineering. And he was at various naval air stations during World War One.
And did you stay in Gillingham, or did the family move?
No, once I was born, which was in December 18, of course, he moved off and stayed with my mother's parents until he found employment and eventually set up his own business as an electrical contractor in Guildford, which is where I most of my childhood was. And then I went to school near Croydon, John Fisher, and having left school, a boarding school, having left school, I then temporarily was found employment by my father in our local business near Guildford, but my heart wasn't in it. I always wanted to fly and I always wanted to go to sea.
That's quite interesting, because obviously given your later career, did you have that early interest in aviation? And how did that manifest itself?
Oh, I think I had model aeroplanes. I did a lot of drawing of aeroplanes. But I think the real encouragement was my school was on the boundaries of Croydon Airport. So, of course, most of the noise in our classrooms was aircraft as opposed to teaching. And we used to go down as a Sunday treat in a crocodile to visit the airport. And we were an absolute pain to the museum guides, because one or two of us were sufficiently clued up to ask very difficult questions. And I had a look of horror on their faces when we appeared.
You mentioned obviously making model aircraft and doing drawings. Did you also follow kind of the exploits of the aviators of the day?
Oh yes, I had, with what pocket money I had, which is not an awful lot, I bought all magazines to do with the flying that I possibly could. And I was also interested in the sea itself, the Navy and so forth. And I thought, toyed with the idea of perhaps becoming a radio operator in the Merchant Navy. I didn't have the background, or my father didn't have the financial resources to send me to Dartmouth, but I had sufficient education to allow me to apply for a naval short service commission, which was an 8-year commission. Had to have my father's permission, as one did in those days. And I was accepted in January 1939 with the rank of midshipman.
Was there a selection procedure that you had to go through?
Yes, I had to be interviewed by a board in the Admiralty, which was quite an experience.
What type of things were they asking you?
Fairly tricky questions about finding one's way around in the country and so on. Difficult to remember so long ago, but about five of them. I don't know what rank they were. They're in plain clothes. I suspect there's a flag officer there, at least one. And in the most marvellous old Admiralty building surroundings, were very impressive. And I didn't think I had a hope. But my headmaster had obviously written a very good report on me, and I was asked to wait, as we all were, about a dozen of us being interviewed, I was feeling even more depressed because I had a chap from Winchester on my right and an Etonian on my left, and my poor school didn't really rate. However, I was called back in and told that they now at that time had sufficient vacancies for pilot training, but there were vacancies for observer training. Would I be interested? So I was absolutely so shattered that I got anywhere at all. And I said, yes, I'll be delighted. And so I started life in the Fleet Air Arm as an observer.
Had they asked about things like mathematics? And I mean, you mentioned about how did you get around, but have they asked about that mathematical knowledge and that sort of thing?
No, not really. You see, I had the equivalent of GCEs and so forth. It's difficult now to describe just really what sort of questions they were. Like you're doing now, they got me talking, and I think from that they could pick up a very good view of the sort of chap I might be and whether I might be suitable.
Can you remember if they asked anything about, obviously, your hobbies, because your interest in aviation and naval matters, or sporting activities? Did they ask about anything?
Yes, I think they delved into what had I done to interest myself in aviation and in the Navy. And I explained that I love drawing ships and aeroplanes. I visited air displays. I had magazines which were specialising in flying and so on. So they should have picked up the fact that I was obviously extremely keen in those two fields, the sea and the air. And as I say, in January 39, I started life as a midshipman. Spared the problems and harrowing times that the chaps later on who went in the Henri R had to do a stint as a naval rating, but I was very spoiled and started as an officer.
Where did that take place? Where did you?
The naval training was in Devonport in a reserve carrier, Hermes. And I suppose there were about courses of 20 to 30 of us arrived every month or so, and we did 3 months naval, purely naval training, entirely naval training, nothing to do with aviation.
So what did that include? What were the types of things that you...
Every subject you can think of, communications, naval drill, naval customs. We were taught how to behave in a boardroom, how to conduct ourselves at dinner and so forth. We all had to take turns as wardroom mess president and so forth. We were given a good insight into naval life for a junior officer. We were closely observed by two regular sub-lieutenants, and they would quickly correct us if we got things wrong at all. And it was really quite a fascinating, a lot of boat work, a lot of sports. It was a very interesting training period of 3 months, but it knocked out all ideas of aviation. We simply didn't have time to think about flying. It was purely Navy.
So am I right in thinking it was just a real introduction to how the Navy operates?
A very, very short course on life in the Navy for someone who hadn't been to Dartmouth or had started on the lower deck. We came in straight. We were all ex-grammar school or public school boys with no, or probably a lot of them, but sailed as a hobby. But that was about it, I think.
You mentioned boat work. What did that involve?
Well, we went off in cutters under the supervision of a naval petty officer, sailed around the local area of Devonport. There were sailing dinghies available for us. We also were put in charge of liberty boats going ashore. Again, there will be our coxswain alongside us. But we got a lot of very useful training. so that when we eventually joined a ship, as all of us did, an aircraft carrier, you know, we were complete, more or less au fait with what went on.
With Hermes, was she, at that stage in the reserve, was she docked in Devonport?
She was out in the centre of the harbour, and in order to get to her, of course, we had to go by boat, which was, as I say, we got training in running these boats. She then, of course, once the war started, because this was all pre-war, was commissioned, went out to the Far East, of course, was sunk in the Indian Ocean, ultimately.
What was she like? Can you give me a description of as a carrier?
Typical aircraft carrier. A flight deck. I had a cabin. I had a marine steward. it was quite good fun. A lot of lectures, of course. The hangars had been converted into lecture rooms, and we were given lectures on the communications, radio, telephony, and on the flight deck, of course, we carried out signalling with flags, drill, marching drill, and so forth, and attended colour ceremonies in the morning and evening. I got a complete insight into the naval life. At the end of the 3 months, we were pretty au fait with a naval routine for a very junior officer.
What degree did you learn communications to?
We were all qualified in the Morse code, for which we got an extra shilling a day, I think, or something quite ridiculous. We could read semaphore, we could use Aldous lamps, little bit of radio telephony, but radio then was fairly elementary. Plenty of radio between ships, but between aircraft still pretty unreliable. So that side it was fairly elementary. We had a couple of instructor commanders who supervised the lectures and so forth.
How did you learn Morse code? What's the procedure for learning it?
How
did you learn Morse code?
We sat in a class with a chap up in the front who had a key, and we listened. He said, this is A, and this is B, and this is C. And we'd had half an hour of this every day. And at the end, most of us qualified, something like 24 words a minute. It became extremely useful, because when I began flying myself, I had an observer who would read the signals from the carrier. But I, of course, having had this training, could read them as well, and I would sometimes get there before he got there.
So it was a good grounding then, was it?
An extremely good grounding, yes, and extremely interesting. We'd all had a uniform allowance of £50, which was quite a lot of money in those days. We all, I think, without exception, went to Gives, the naval tailor, and I can remember my account with Gives is the number now, 34244, up until the time I retired 30 years later.
What was the uniform for a midshipman at that time?
Then we just wore our we had a normal uniform reefer jacket, but without any identifications other than white patches, the midshipman's white patches up here. But for working rig, we had just uniform blue trousers and a white sweater and a uniform cap. We were then part of the air branch of the Royal Navy. It wasn't called the Fleet Air Arm, it was called the air branch. Ultimately became the Fleet Air Arm, of course.
You mentioned drill on board the ship. How did you take to drill?
I can't say. That's probably something I didn't enjoy too much. The form of the drill was twofold. One, the straightforward drill that you'd have on a parade ground, but it was also used for the moving of ships. We each became the equivalent of a destroyer, and we would have to alter course and take up various dispositions that ships would take up at sea as a result of flag signals, and we would learn to do that as well. But we were, of course, amusing incidents when some of us who were not terribly bright at this would have their squad, if that's what you call it, marching firmly across the flight deck, and the strike sense of panic, couldn't remember how to stop them, and of course there's a fair chance they go straight to that sort of incident made life amusing. And some failed, of course, didn't make it. We were constantly marked and monitored and had exams in the subjects that we'd been taught, and I suppose about a fifth of those who joined failed the course and didn't make it.
It's quite a high percentage, I would say.
It's fairly high, yes.
Who was instructing you at that stage?
Well, a mixture of pretty well all the branches of the Navy. The captain was an executive commander. You had the normal complement you'd have on an aircraft carrier, less, of course, the flying element. And because it was primarily lectures, we had instructors from the instructor branch, instructor commanders and so forth. And a lot of what I would call I was trying to remember the, from HMS Excellent, the gunners area, tough petty officers and chief petty officers who were the equivalent of the army sergeants for army recruits, and treated us in much the same way.
Obviously, these days there are stories of bullying of recruits in the armed forces. How were you treated at that stage?
There was some bullying, even though we were all junior officers. I didn't come across it, but I think there was an element of ex-public school boys who had probably been in a bullying environment, and I know that this went on in the ship. But I personally, and my own particular chums, were not subjected to this and not really entirely conscious of what was going on. But looking back, there must have been some sort of bullying of that sort going on. But bearing in mind that we were a pretty educated lot, wouldn't really expect too much of that, and the age range was 17, I think, up to 22. That was sort of limit when applying for the short service commissions. That was the age range that you had to be. I was about 19.
And given that, obviously, you've mentioned that at that stage it wasn't the Fleet Air Arm, it was the Air Branch of the Navy. What was the status of how was the Fleet Air Arm perceived really at that stage amongst the Navy?
I don't think at that stage we were aware of the political background to the formation of the RAF relative to the Army, and in 1918 when the RFC became the RAF, and the Navy relinquished control of its aviation element. It's only more recently that we became conscious of the fact, particularly when we began to realise very early on that we were flying very antiquated aircraft, which was obviously the result of two things. One, I think, the difficulty that the executive branch of the Navy had in accepting aviation. They were not convinced that aeroplanes could sink ships, and found out the hard way. And the inter-service rivalry, where the newly formed RAF decided that anything that flew was their responsibility. And so we had this rather unhappy situation, which again, at our or my level, we were not terribly conscious of. It was some years later when I began to talk and read about the background and why the hell are we flying these clapped out aircraft when, you know, if we'd had the opportunity to design our own aircraft from the beginning, we would have had, like the American Navy, aircraft built for maritime carrier-borne operations. So I think there was a certain amount, later on in the, as we got on, a certain amount of unhappiness. That didn't prevent us getting on with the RAF serving alongside us, but it clearly, at a more senior level, led to a lot of problems, politically particularly.
And given the time when you joined the Royal Navy, had you any anticipations of the situation in Europe escalating to war?
Oh yes, I think I wanted to go and I wanted to take an RAF short service commission. I think flying was really my priority, although I was interested in the sea. But my father wouldn't allow me to go, take up an RAF short service commission. It's only 4 years, and he knew a lot of RAF who had come out at the end of their 4 years and hadn't succeeded terribly well. And so I was resigned to not being allowed to apply. And then suddenly the RAF, the Navy decided they were short of air crews and instituted the 8-year short service commission. And my father, I think, realised that I was desperate to get into something like that. And also, of course, he could see the war coming. So he said, yes, apply. And so I did. And of course, it's exactly what I wanted. I wanted the sea and I wanted the air. And I probably might not have survived if I'd been in the RAF. But of course, they had a tremendous casualty rate, and I was lucky in the Navy. I would have had a totally different life if I'd gone into the RAF. But I'm always extremely grateful to my guardian angel who steered me into combining Navy and the air.
So had your father taken the attitude, really, that it was probably better for you to have the choice of what you went into?
Well, he thought the 8 years was a better deal than 4 years. One obviously would have a much, much better financial gratuity at the end of that term. But, of course, the whole thing was a bit uncertain because of it. In 1939, quite clearly, the war was going to start at some stage. But it's interesting that in those days one normally got one's permission from one's parents, quite unlike today, of course, and quite right too.
And with the situation in Germany, how aware were you of what had happened in Germany with the growth of Nazism?
I regret to say that I really didn't pay an awful lot of attention to what was going on that I can recall. I really think I read the newspapers. I could see, I think, that there were going to be problems, that the war probably would start. One couldn't avoid discovering that, but I was so desperately involved in what I was doing that I think that I wasn't as conscious of the political situation as perhaps I should have been, looking back.
Given you saying that you were involved in what you were doing, am I right in assuming then that you were very keen on the work and you enjoyed that?
Oh, I enjoyed it all, and the training was very much a... We didn't have time in the evenings to put our feet up and watch TV. There was always something else laid on in the way of instructional work and so on. Shore going was limited to local runs ashore. Not overnight, we had to be back on board. So it was a fairly rigorous thing, but interesting. I don't think I ever felt at all unhappy. I thought, golly, this is something I'm so glad I've taken up.
Were you expected to do a certain amount of sort of evening study, in the sense that I was thinking of maybe seamanship manuals or that type
of thing? Oh, yes. The seamanship manual was our Bible. One of the other tasks we had to do was officer of the watch in harbour. We would understudy the officer of the watch. We'd be the second officer of the watch, and we would be involved in the whole administration of the ship in the course of the day, from sailors going ashore on liberty or coming back very drunk to supply ships coming alongside, making absolutely sure that correct salutes were rendered to passing ships. You had to know the seniority of the captain of the ship going by. All of that was our part of our instruction. So, of course, there was an awful lot going on.
How do you learn something like that? The, as you said, the seniority of a ship going, or the captain of the ship going by. Is it purely by rote that you would learn?
No, we had a navy list. The officer of the watch would have a navy list, and in any case, there were daily signals outlining ship's movements, so you had a pretty good idea which ship would in fact be passing you, or either coming into harbour or going out of harbour. So it wasn't all that difficult. And we had a marine band, which was great fun. It saw a lot of the ceremonial, which was again interesting.
Could you mention Navy traditions as well? How much emphasis was placed on you as a midshipman to understand the traditions and the history of the Navy at that
time? Not a lot, specifically instruction in tradition, but I personally, and I suppose many others of my colleagues, had done a lot of reading, and I read Marryat and various other authors who are famous for naval stories. I knew a lot about Nelson. That I have acquired of my own, volition. But I don't think I cannot recall any specific instruction in the traditions of the Navy, other than when it would perhaps come up in the course of signalling. Probably the instructor would give the background to it, how it started in the Navy, that sort of thing. I think that's about the only, what I would call, instruction and tradition that we would come across.
So as a midshipman, were you really meant to kind of absorb this tradition that's around you, rather than it being specific instruction?
Yes, that's right. I think one also bear in mind that getting into the Navy at that sort of level was really quite something. Normally, to be commissioned in the armed services at that time, before the war, it was either Sandhurst, Dartmouth, or Cranwell. And I think all of us thought this opportunity really was quite something, if we could make the grade. And so there was that enormous enthusiasm there. And those who didn't make it were clearly very, very distraught, because of their failure to achieve what they had hoped they would achieve.
What happened with those who failed on that level of the course? Would there be something?
That was quite interesting. I don't know what happened to those who failed in Hermes, but when I did my observer course, I completed the course and was sent for by the training commander, who said that I'm terribly sorry, but your training is terminated, and you are to return home and await orders. And I said, does that mean I'm leaving the Navy? He said, well, I can't comment on that, but in my instructions are to send you home, and you should wait there to hear what your future will be. And that happened to about 8 of us in my particular course. we were all very boot-faced about this, and we were off the local railway station and went to our various homes, including one of them who was almost a neighbour of mine in Guildford. He also had this rather dreary end to his training. He'd been in Hermes, obviously. And when I got home, I would keep in touch with him by telephone, saying, have you heard anything yet? And he'd say, no, I haven't. A chap called Parsons. And one day I got a letter from their lordships saying I was to report for flying training at RAF Elmden, Birmingham. I thought, golly, this is absolutely marvellous. So I rang my chum up. He said, I've had a letter saying I'm dismissed forthwith. And so I'm going to join the RAF, which he did. And poor Chaffee was killed. But that was the way and I'm looking back on that, I think the Navy was having some difficulty in estimating the air crews that they needed.